Welcome back to Feminist Book Club, the podcast. We're not just about feminist books. We are here for social justice, literature, and media in all its forms. But we do that through an intersectional feminist lens. Thanks for being here. Let's get started. Did you know that the most important human invention was gynecology? Not fire, not stone tools, not the wheel, not penicillin, gynecology. What about the fact that humans are not the only species to have abortions? Or that female bodies are probably what led the way to bipedalism? This is just some of what you'll learn when you read Eve, how the female body drove 200 million years of human evolution by Kat Bohannon. For the last 2,000 years, the story of humanity has been written mostly by men about men. What's more, for over a century, the female body has been drastically left out of biological and medical research. That's slowly starting to change, and what we're learning about the biology of sex differences is rewriting the story of humanity and the story of our bodies, what they really are, how they really work, and where they really come from. Even though we're just starting to scratch the surface of that story, the story itself is 200 million years old. Eve is that story. This book is so fascinating. It's also engaging, easy to follow, and often hilarious. So it's no surprise that it was an instant New York Times bestseller and that it's been longlisted for the Women's Prize for Nonfiction. We also love that Eve is inclusive of trans identities, which is sadly still not the norm for these types of books. So if you've ever wondered why women outlive men or whether or not we evolved to be sexist, you're going to want to check out Eve by Kat Bohannon. Thank you so much for sponsoring this episode.
Greetings, friends. I'm Mariquita Guerrera. Pronouns are she, her, hers. And today we are joined by V. Castro, whose book, The Haunting of Alejandra, was a real fan favorite among our readers. I am certain that her newest book, Immortal Pleasures, which I know many folks are eagerly anticipating, will likewise not disappoint. Thank you so much for talking with us today, V.
Oh, thank you for having me. Honestly, it's such an honor when I'm asked to do these things because I love connecting with the readers. And it's just such a privilege. You know, I love what I do, and all of these things help me to continue to do them, if that makes sense. So thank you. Thank you, guys.
We love what you do, too.
Thank you.
I'm really excited for our discussion today. There's so much I want to talk about, but before we get into it, I'd like for you to tell us a little bit about Immortal Pleasures.
Yes. So Immortal Pleasures, look, so I started out self-publishing like way back because no one would publish me and I couldn't get an agent. And it started as just like a little thing that I self-published, like 10,000 words, but I wanted it, you know, to be bigger. And eventually as my career progressed, I was like, you know what? Now's the time to do it. Now I can do it. So I took it off and I wrote the novel. And with Alejandra, I got a 2-book deal and I was like, this could be the second book. Thankfully, they accepted it. But Immortal Pleasures follows La Malinche or Malinali. And she's a real historical character in Mexican history. Well, what we now call Mexico, right? I just felt like she's such an amazing character. Yet like a lot of characters, a lot of mythologies and folklore of the indigenous population before the conquest, before Mexico was called Mexico, a lot of it was lost. And I wanted to kind of reclaim that because, you know, a lot of stories, you have to question, well, where did the narrative originate? Kind of like La Llorona in The Haunting of Alejandra. Where did the story originate? And same with Malinali, La Malinche. You know, we know people want to call her a traitor, but what would you do if you were sold by your mother, your own, you know, to another tribe, and then in turn that tribe sold you to these new people that you'd never met before, that you didn't even know existed? You were essentially a slave, right? How would you have reacted? And she was bright. She was brilliant. Unfortunately, she did die young, like a lot of the indigenous population. And I love vampires. I love horror. I love sex. I love writing about all of that. And I thought, you know what? She lived such a remarkable and sad life. I want to give her another life. And so I made her into a vampire. But I wanted to, you know, put in those bits and pieces of her early life. Now, there are parts I did not talk about because she was underage. And I just don't think A, it's appropriate for this type of book, but B, in general, that's not what I want to focus on. I don't want to focus on her trauma or her torture. Yes, you do see some of the pain, but I didn't want to go into any kind of assaults. I do talk about, it's intimated. Obviously, she had two children by Spanish men. You know, the readers are not dumb. It obviously was not consensual. But again, she was owned. So saying no and fighting someone off, that wasn't even an option. It was just like, that's your duty. And I wanted to just show that as well, that it wasn't as simple as someone coming in and attacking her. She had no choice. And that's just as bad as saying no, no, no. Because then people look at you like, well, you're complicit in it. And that's what a lot of people see her. Oh, you're complicit into your circumstance. But really, no, she was, I don't want to say victim of her times, because I wanted her not to be a victim in this book, but that's kind of, her life. That was her journey. And I wanted to honor her.
I want to talk more about that. But I think what I want to discuss first is the thing that struck me immediately when I read this is how horror and the West has a history of leveraging racist tropes or anxieties and reframing those anxieties as ghouls, villains, boogeymen, the most common or pervasive example perhaps being the zombie, which was taken from the Haitian religions. But there have certainly been others. And we've talked on this podcast about the importance of post-colonial Gothic or post-colonial horror in taking those tropes and turning the mirror on them. And Immortal Pleasures seems to fit comfortably within the genre of post-colonial horror, and not even tongue-in-cheek, as like the capital C colonizer Cortez himself is a major villain in this book. What role do you think horror has in reclaiming the narrative originally dictated and directed by colonizers?
Oh my God. I mean, real life horror is worse than any, it is horror. Some real life horrors are worse than any horror. The Middle Passage, for example. I mean, my brain cannot think of something more horrific, sad doesn't even, that's not even the right word, absolutely so heartbreaking and soul crushing that was part of human history, right? You just, what would aliens say? These evolved, aliens come down and think these beings would, and you tell them the history of humanity, what would they think? I mean, you think, oh my God. And so these horrors, they're absolutely still, generational trauma is a thing, right? It is something, identity, before, when the Spanish arrived, a new race was born, literally a new race was born, because the indigenous and mixing with the Spanish and Portuguese, and then in other places, like you see in Brazil with the African, and also with the islands, right? These new races were born, these new people and these new histories, but they were born from trauma. And so I want to highlight those things. And, we cannot go back and correct things. And even though we can try to course correct now, we're still feeling the effects of those things, right? And so that's why I really like writing about it and not being apologetic and reclaiming it, because otherwise you're just whitewashing, you're assimilating, you're denying a part of your identity. And why oppress or suppress something that you had no control over? Examine it so we can learn, we can move forward, we can heal, and hopefully not make the same mistakes. We should revive those histories and those mythologies and those stories.
As you mentioned earlier, La Malinche, Malinali's reputation in Mexico and Central America has shifted and remains still quite contentious. In your book, she bristles at this a bit and at the blame cast upon her for her part in furthering Cortez's genocide of the indigenous peoples, saying that an enslaved person can never love their master. How have you chosen to take her story and to frame it?
Well, like I want to say, for example, we know Jefferson had children with his slaves, right? And we know, Cortez took this woman, Malinalli, and you have this art that portrays, her in his arms and this romantic idea. I've seen those paintings, and they make me absolutely sick to my stomach. Absolutely. You want to tell me that these women who are forcibly taken into their masters' homes were really like living in this romantic, idealized situation that they were, some people would say, well, oh, maybe they were experienced Stockholm syndrome. No, I maybe some, but I'm sorry, that is just grotesque. And to perpetuate that idea is grotesque, and to accept it is grotesque. So for me, I wanted to show, that's why I wrote that line, is that I reject those murals, I reject those paintings, I reject that romanticizing of her living this life with him, or the man she was given, who in turn took all her land and she had another child with. I can't even. So I wanted again to show that, but also show when she had these children, that was such a disassociation, especially with everything that's happening in the in with women's bodies and their choice to have a child or not, when you're forced into that situation. I'm not going to sit there and say she had these babies and magically fell in love with them. That's doing her and so many other women a disservice.
Complexity that you show about her connection to those children is really remarkable because she does feel for them, but it's a complicated kind of feeling. She wants to protect them, but also these aren't children that were born out of love. They weren't
No.
born out of a loving union.
No. And also back then, as a woman, you get pregnant, it's like, oh, am I gonna die? A lot of women did not survive it. So that's another thing. How do you feel about that?
Even as she seems to take issue with the way that others sort of make her complicit in Cortez's campaign, she does seem to like feel a level of culpability in it. It is part of her seeking out stolen artifacts and returning them sort of a type of penance, do you think?
I think it is like almost, so there's a thing in spirituality called soul retrieval, and I follow this amazing curandera, Erica Buenaflor, and I've had reading with her, and she has amazing books. She's a wonderful curandera out of LA that I highly recommend. And she's written books about soul retrieval and healing trauma and healing generational trauma. And for me, it was a physical, practical way of her practicing soul retrieval, of healing wounds within herself, but also for reconciling what happened to her people, to her country, to everything, right? And also kind of saying, I'm going to be successful. I am going to make something of myself, and I'm going to be greater than any of you, because y'all are all dead and I'm not. But yes, it was a way of also saying, you know what, I'm going to do something about this now that I can, now that I am empowered again, now that I choose my destiny. That was definitely part of it.
All right, I've got one last question for you. Are you ready?
Yeah,
All
of
right.
course.
What makes Malinalli a feminist historical figure?
Being in control of her body, mind, and spirit, and not apologizing for it. That's why. For her, she can be who she is, and she doesn't have to hide.
I really love that you brought new life to this
Thank you.
person who was denied so much of her own personhood during her lifetime, and whose story was taken from her and retold by the men who controlled her. Giving her this new narrative was really a powerful thing to read. So, thank you so
Thank
much.
you. Honestly, it's for every person out there who's ever felt like that. you know, I feel like her spirit can really empower people, and her strength and her being like hitting rock bottom, literally. And I think it could, it's meant to be out there to be a light, even though it is a super dark theme, but it's also in parts light and playful and, you know, sensual. And she can, and you see her transformation. And I hope that other people can take that and say, you know what? Transformation can happen at any point in your life. And no matter who you are worthy, you're good enough. You can do it too.
Yeah. I mean, I could sit with you and talk with you for hours about the, like the historical research you've done for this book, which is evident in the pages, the art that's referenced, the symbolism that you've woven throughout. This is a rich book, truly. Thank you for sharing it with us.
Thank you so much.
Where can folks find you online?
Oh my goodness. We talked about this before. So, Twitter. Yes, I'm still calling it Twitter. And Instagram, I'm at The Latina London. On TikTok, I'm V Castro Books. If you look up V Castro, V Latina London, I'm everywhere.
We'll get it in the show notes.
Yeah, I hope everyone will pre-order. Pre-orders are so important to writers, and it keeps, again, like I said, it keeps me going. Every little bit helps. So yeah, you can find me hanging around all over the place.
Wonderful. And again, I'm Mariquita Guerrero. We've just been having the best conversation with V. Castro about Immortal Pleasures, published April 16th by Delray Books. If you're looking for me online, you can find me on Instagram at @O_Murray. Until next time, friends, be well.
What would you do? Kira's entire reputation is built upon the development of ethical computing. Her AI, Ellie, is the testbed and best example of using her moral operating system. Her absolute dedication to improving kids' lives could now put all she's worked for at risk. Kira thought she and Ellie, with her ethical framework, could keep everything under control. Against conventional wisdom, it's not the AI's moral decision-making that's the problem, it's the people. This is the setup for Moral Code by Lois and Ross Melbourne, a science fiction novel that explores themes of corporate ethics, exploitation, and the intersection of innovation and morality. When Dr. Kira Stetson merges her company with billionaire Roy Brandt's secretive nanite technology, she finally has access to some much-needed funds. Kira's decision to embed her moral operating system into Brandt's nanite smart dust reflects her commitment to ethical technology development. But it turns out, there's a reason his technology has been such a closely guarded secret. Now she must confront the sinister motives of corporate raiders and the military who seek to weaponize Brandt's nanites, posing a threat to both individuals and society at large. Moral Code asks the reader to consider important and interesting questions, ones that are particularly relevant right now with the rise of AI and the ever-growing greed of capitalist interests. Plus, we want to highlight that 100% of the proceeds generated through the sales of Moral Code will be donated to help fight the child abuse and human trafficking of kids. You can learn more about Moral Code and download a free chapter at moralcodethebook.com. Thank you so much for sponsoring this episode.
Hey everyone, my name is Jordy and I use she, her pronouns. And I'm joined today by two other contributors.
Hello, I'm Ra and my pronouns are they, them.
Hi, I'm Vari and my pronouns are also she, her.
And we are here to discuss our varying degrees of love and experience when it comes to all things manga and anime related. In this discussion, we'll be diving into a brief history of manga, including an overview of the women in manga, how we got into the genre, and a bookish discussion on the first volume of The Witch Hat Atelier by Kamome Shirahama. Without further ado, I know Ra has been doing some deep dives into the lore of manga. So Ra, if you could please share with us your research and insights.
Okay. So y'all, I need to start off with saying that while I was doing my like big deep dive yesterday, my TV broke when I was trying to stream a documentary. So I did get a lot of work done though. So I don't want to call this like a brief history. I want to call this more like an introduction, you know, because when I set out to gather this brief history, I didn't really realize what I was getting into, and it is huge and daunting. And yeah, so I'm going to do my best and share what I have gathered, but I highly recommend checking out the videos that I'm linking in the show notes to check out yourself to go deeper into this history, because I know for a fact that I'm not going to fully do it justice. And this is just like scraping the surface, which is okay, you know? So a brief, ultra brief introduction. The easy definition is that they are comics or graphic novels that originated in Japan, right? Like we can all say that. We all agree with that. But manga was actually popularized in the US in the 80s and 90s. But the first use of the word has been traced back to 1798 by artist, poet, and writer Santo Kyoden. But please note, obviously this manga from this late 1700s is not what we see today. It's going to be more like political cartoons. And from what I heard, there were like priests and monks that were kind of throwing shade at each other. I don't have the full information on that because I was getting very lost and confused. And there was just so much history in that specific genre of manga itself. So as we move on, we got Rakuten Kitazawa, who is the first person who used the word manga in the way that we use it today. And he is referred to as the father of modern manga. And I'm just going to keep throw another name out here, all right? So another important name is Osamu Tezuka, who is known as the manga god. This is when things started to get a little bit more popular in the 80s and 90s because his works included Astro Boy, Kimba the White Lion, Princess Knight, and I guess over like 600 different types of publications that went out. He had his hand in. And there's a lot about Princess Knight and how she developed a lot of strong female characters as well. But once again, that lore is so deep and rich that I cannot do it justice with an ultra brief history.
Yeah, it's almost like we would need several mini series of this going to get the full picture and effects.
I feel like I need like a solid month to actually like do the research, because as I was like diving in, I was like, okay, like we have all these different little categories. Yeah, like I said, it was just daunting to figure out where to start. The history is just so rich considering it goes back to 1798. It's like, what am I supposed to do with that?
Well, it's fascinating so far.
So we get into the different types of manga. Just like anything has genres or demographics within itself, manga does as well. And these are separated into four main categories. We have shoujo, which is it's directed towards girls ages 9 to 18. So this is going to be a manga like Fruit Baskets by Natsuki Takaya, which was one of the first manga series to hit the national bestseller list in the US. And then Sailor Moon is also considered a shoujo, which many Americans do love, including myself. And that was by Naoko Takeuchi. There's shoujo. Then we got shonen, which is for boys ages 9 to 18. So that's going to be more like your Dragon Ball Z and One Piece, which I feel like has become household names for a lot of people in the United States as well. Then we get into our adult demographic mangas, which we have josei, which is for adult women. We got 18 to 40 years on that, because apparently after the age of 40, you're supposed to just age out of manga. You're supposed to be an adult and just not read comic books anymore. So an example of that would be Happy Marriage by Maki Inochi, Injochi, sorry about that. And then we have Senen, which is for adult men, 18 to 40. Here's a little interesting thing in Witcha Atelier. This is considered a Senen. So it does go into the adult men category randomly. So oh, wow. I was surprised. Yeah, I was surprised. But it's because it was originally released in Konanasha's Senen magazine called Morning 2. So mangas typically will get published in a magazine first before it heads into its own volume. So Witch Hat Atelier has been coming out like monthly in this magazine. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, once as many chapters are out, you got the volume and you can purchase the volume, which is what we buy in the Western area. They have like shoujo magazines, shonen magazines, which like One Piece was from Shonen Jump, josei, and then yeah, seinen magazines. And josei tends to be the least popular, I guess, when you look at it.
I was just gonna say that's so interesting because like we'll get into this when we get into the book discussion side of things, but advertised in a magazine that I'm assuming is read by mostly men, since it falls into that category, is just so interesting to me. I wonder why it was chosen to be published through that route first.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it's safe to say that like with anybody, with any genre. Anyone can go anywhere. Like, we're not stuck to a certain binary. I want to go through our last two. I got some niche demographics that I'd like to go through, and then I'll go a little bit further. But we also got the niche. We got the niche. and they're called Yuri, which is girl love. So these are going to have lesbian themes. And then we got Yaoi, which is boy love, which is going to have gay themes. So those are a couple of niche themes that we got there that people tend to buy if they are into manga. Yeah, I love that. Each genre and demographic have specific themes that get touched on and will have similar styles. So, you know, like your shoujos are going to have like more romantic themes. Josei might have a little bit more drama. Your shonens will typically have a protagonist that's under the age of 12. So obviously people do not stay in these demographics as many adults love shonens. Like, I'm a big fan of One Piece and Pokemon, which I think is actually originated for children under the age of 9. And many women write shonens and seinens. The word shoujo literally translates to the word girl, but it is not the only genre that women are limited to, because recently I learned that popular animes that I knew growing up were written by women. So are you ready to be surprised?
I am.
Okay. Yes. Inuyasha was written by Rumiko Takahashi. Full Metal Alchemist was written by Hiromu Arakawa. And then Demon Slayer was written by Koyoharu Gotyoge. Oh. All written by women. Very popular animes that took the United States, or at least like, I feel like I'm very surface level anime fan, manga fan. Like, I'm not super deep into it. Like many others are. I wouldn't have had any idea that they were women writers.
Yeah, me neither. I also just want to say for people out there who are very new to all of this, like I am, I didn't realize that anime meant the animated version of the manga. So in case any listeners didn't know that either, there's that little tidbit.
Yeah, it'll start off as a manga and then go into an anime. And then one other thing that I wanted to add about my little brief introduction is there were two groups of women that formed that influenced how manga was created and how it grew and how the art form just became elevated. So there are two groups called Year 24 and Clamp. So these were around the 70s, 80s, and 90s, which I don't think they're actually still together today.
That's fair. That's a history, you know.
Yeah, it's a long, deep history that I was not aware of. And I think the cool thing about manga that we need to keep in mind is that this is a publication that was created in a different culture. So we need to make sure that we're like keeping that in mind. Like, this is not westernized.
Kind of in a similar vein to what you just mentioned, you know, going into manga, I knew just because people told me, you know, you read it the opposite way from what we're used to here in the US. Where you read right to left. And so I knew that I was going to be starting at what I would assume is like the back of the book, which is really the front of the book. But then I didn't put two and two together. And even on the pages, I was trying to read left to right. And I was like, I'm kind of getting what's happening here, but it doesn't feel right. Like, I feel like I'm still missing something, and I had to go to YouTube, and I YouTubed, you know, how to read the pages. And so it wasn't until I saw somebody actually do it that I realized what I was doing wrong. And then everything fell into place and it made sense from there.
It's just like how you read a comic book, but in the opposite.
Yeah.
Yeah. I didn't grow up reading comic books either, though. So I didn't even have that experience to go off of.
I mean, like, I have read comic books. I'm not like a big comic book nerd, but I have read, you know, westernized comics in the past. But even for me, it was like a fairly big adjustment reading like the opposite way around to what I'm used to. And also, I also had to Google it, because just like you get in western comic books, you'll get like two or three little panels lined up exactly with a massive panel, and then it's like, well, which one, in what order do I read those panels? Clearly I go from, you know, the top of the page to the bottom of the page, but do I read the smaller panels on the one side and then the larger one? Or so, yeah, I had to give it a little look up. It definitely slowed me down, which is good, because a lot of what's conveyed in manga is through illustration. So it definitely helped me pay more attention to that, which was cool.
Especially with like how artists will choose how everything flows. Like we could definitely see how things flowed in Witch Hat Atelier. That, did I say that right?
Atelier.
Ah, okay. This is going to be a struggle. Atelier, the images in Witch Hat Atelier, the way that the graphics were flowing and how it would take its time with the panels and how certain things would flow into the next page. And it didn't all just feel very like it. This needs to fit in this panel. This needs to fit in this panel. I like that in my comic books. And I feel like it gives the artist more, what's the word, power in how they want their reader to read their work.
Yeah, I can see that. I think it gives more power to like the, obviously the visuals they're trying to create compared to like a written book. Which you can go off, like, have you ever read a book and then watch the movie and you're like, oh, that is not how I pictured that character and now I'm upset about it, or that is not how I pictured that scene or how this played out in my head. Yeah, I think the way that, at least the manga that we've read, I know there's so many different ways of doing it, you know, but the one that we've read, I definitely feel like there's a flow to it, like the author is pulling you naturally in a direction, which is really cool.
Yeah, I felt like while I was reading it, I caught myself not paying enough attention to the illustrations. Like, I feel like I'm so trained to read the words, move on, read the words, move on. And I felt like, one, that just wasn't helpful for understanding the story completely. And two, just I feel like the amount of effort and work and time that it must have gone into making these illustrations and doing all of this stuff, like you really have to sit there and just appreciate the artwork. And I thought it was gorgeous and I had such a fun time reading it. I look forward to reading more manga in the future.
Well, should we go into a little description of what Witch Hat Atelier, I said it wrong again.
The Witch Hat Atelier, yes. So the description for this is, in a world where everyone takes wonders like magic spells and dragons for granted, Coco is a girl with a simple dream. She wants to be a witch, but everybody knows magicians are born, not made. And Coco was not born with a gift for magic. Resigned to her unmagical life, Coco is about to give up on her dream to become a witch until the day she meets Clifrey. That's what I was saying. Is that how you guys were saying?
That's how I was reading it.
Clifrey? Okay. A mysterious traveling magician. After secretly seeing Clifrey perform magic in a way she's never seen before, Coco soon learns what everyone knows might not be the truth and discovers that her magical dream may not be as far away as it seems. So how did you guys feel about this manga?
I mean, it was cute. It's the perfect introduction manga to give to anybody, no matter what their age. Like if they're an adult who wants to maybe experience a little bit of joy, you might need to tell them to read 1, 2, and 3. I haven't read 2 or 3 yet, but the only reason why I say that is because there's so much world building in that first one where it's kind of like, it's just facts a little bit. So I'm very excited to move on in the series. I'm very happy that we had this world building in the first one. Yeah, it's just cute. It's witches and a little witch that wants to be a witch and learns how to be a witch. And I love that for her.
I loved it. I loved that the end of the story, because it's not really the end of the story, because this manga has, as of this year, 12 volumes, and we've read number one and that's it. We all did that and stopped at it. So I kind of got to the end and I want to know what happens now. So obviously I've ordered volume 2 and 3, and this manga is going to take up a whole bookshelf, like a whole shelf on my bookcase at this point, I feel like. So cheers for this, Geordie. I'm blaming you. But yeah, I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, I'll gladly take the blame for that. I feel like as soon as I got comfortable with the format of reading it and understanding what was happening, because I feel like when I started reading it, my brain was actively trying to get me to go back and read the way I'm used to. And so that was a little difficult to begin with. And so I had to read it and, you know, like 10 pages or less at a time. But yeah, I felt like once I kind of picked up on everything and I was in a groove and I got super interested into it, and all of a sudden just ended. And I was like, no, like I need the next one. I need to know what happens. But yeah, my friend told me to start with this one. And I think it was such a great recommendation. It was super sweet, heartwarming, a lot of fun. There was so much into it. Love the illustrations. I thought it was a good time. And I really liked how the witches, like their training came through drawings that they had to do. And that's how they kind of harness their magic. And I think that's a really fun concept.
I feel like it definitely gives the artist a lot of like fun creative options. But what I really like is that there is lore to the magic and how it works and what different symbols mean. And the book or the manga explains that. But at the end, there is also like a couple pages that kind of work as like an overview or a glossary or something like that. And it gives you like little symbols that are used and what they mean, and then the lore behind them and which element they're attached to, and like gives you an example of how it's used somewhere in the story. I thought that was like really extra, and like that really kind of pulls you in, I think. So
yeah, extra and definitely needed, especially for people like me. I think it helps with the visual concept and keeping everything straight, because there's no way going into the next volumes, if they didn't have that, I would be flipping through the pages to try to remember everything. So definitely very helpful.
It's definitely a very art forward book. Like people's creativity, what they draw, what they make, are what they are able to put out in the world and make magic out of. Like it makes me think of that beginning part where Coco is just meeting Quifri for the first time. And she's just laying out fabric, and he called that magic in itself. So I'm very curious to know if there's other forms of like creativity that show up that are forms of magic in this manga as we move forward in the story.
I love that scene that you just referenced, is there is a callback to that later in the story, which obviously I don't want to give any spoilers in case anyone wants to jump in on this after us. But
I mean, it's a whole world building book, so I don't know.
Well, you know, but like I like that it's called back in later in the story and used in a way to like push the story forward. I think that's really clever. So, I mean, I'm pretty easily impressed, but I was impressed. In fact, I enjoyed this. This was my first ever foray into manga at all. Like I'm not a huge anime fan, although like most people, if pressed, I can give you a couple of animes that I'm into just by chance. This came up for me. Geordie suggested this in our little feminist book club chat, and I was like, you know what, why not, I'll give it a go. And now I've ordered not only the next two volumes of Witch Hat Atelier, but do you know how many mangas there are featuring cats? Yeah, see, now I'm into manga.
A bunch.
Yeah. I have ordered a bunch of other mangas. Just, you know, yeah, I fell down a whole rabbit hole. So
a lot of silly story ones where people turn into cats. People fall in love with cats. Yeah, it can get a little weird sometimes.
I feel like with the way people describe what's out there with manga is whatever you could possibly be looking for, you can find something that fits that description or very closely related to.
Which is why those demographics help. Like if you're really like, I don't know what I want to read, like you can, you know that you're going to get some action with a seinen or a shonen, you know you're going to get some like romance or drama with a josei or shoujo or magical girl. I guess magical girl genre is in the shoujo or demographic.
I just remember being surprised at how many options are out there. But I used to work at a bookstore and most of my coworkers were obsessed with manga. And so that's how I kind of got introduced to it and stuff like that. But I used to work at a partly used bookstore. And if we had manga that came in that was explicit when it came to romance stories and stuff like that, we had to wrap it. And I just remember thinking, wow, this is like so insane. Like, this is wild to me, but like, it's pretty cool.
Yeah. So I went looking for the next, I bought my first volume of Witch Hat Atelier secondhand. I think most of us did. And then I went looking for volumes 2 and 3, and I have found that volume 2 is easily obtained secondhand online. But once you start going past that, they get a little bit harder to find as secondhand books. So anyway, long story short, I ended up on a site that specializes in manga, basically. And for the uninitiated, like, it can be a bit of a not safe for work surprise when you go looking, especially if you're not necessarily looking for a specific title, or if you fall down the rabbit hole of, if you like this, you might like this. If any new manga people are gonna go looking, just be aware that that is something that you might come across. I feel like I should put that out there.
Sometimes mangas get weird and not safe for work kind of ways,
and spicy.
People should, yes, and not safe for work kind of ways, but sometimes you want to read them, and that's okay. We love erotica. But yeah, just be aware when you're Googling and looking things up that not everything is going to be about cats.
And some of the stuff about cats is still going to be not safe for work, so, which is fine, but if you're not expecting it, it could be a little bit of a like,
Yeah, that would be a surprise for sure.
Okay, I got one question about the witch hat.
Atelier.
Atelier. Oh, no! Atelier! Well, who's your favorite character? Do you have one? I know it's just the first one. We have so many to be introduced to, but...
So I don't know if anyone else can relate to this, but I feel like when I read a book for the first time... Like, if it's been more than like 4 days from talking about it, I feel like my brain just does a dump. And so I can only really remember Coco and Master Kifri. But like, I remember all the side characters, but like, I just cannot remember their names. But I will say that I feel like Coco brought out the inner child in me, and just like her want for like adventure and curiosity was just so fun to see come to life on the page. So I appreciated that aspect of it, and I'm looking forward to connecting with more characters in the future.
So I kind of liked Agot. I'm not sure if that's how you actually say that, but that's how my brain reads it. Who was kind of the like antagonist? Is that the right? Am I using that the right way? In the story, she was like kind of the sort of villain witch in a way. But I like that she's in there, and I like the way that she's written. Obviously, I really enjoyed Coco, which, you know, Coco's the main character, so you're supposed to love her. And I just kind of loved all the like the young witch characters and the fact that they're so different from each other, and just, you know, the way that they all were interacting with Coco was really endearing to me, even the evil one.
I wanted to know their backstories and how they ended up at the place that they were. So I'm hoping that we get more of their stories in the upcoming series. But who is your favorite, Ra?
I'm only going to say I don't know the character's name because I don't think they're named. But the witch with the eye, Brim, I just thought that character was so beautifully drawn, and we don't know what that character is doing there, but you know that they're going to play a big deal in it. And essentially, this mysterious creature, for our listeners, this mysterious witch is someone who hands Coco a book of forbidden spells that she's not supposed to have. That evil witch or forbidden spell witch just pieces out and shows back up in the end. I like him or her, them. I like them.
Oh, I love them. I can't wait to see what they turn out to be, because you're right, like that character kind of started the whole thing, or at least it's heavily alluded to they started the whole thing, and then they make a couple of appearances at the end. Yeah, no, I'm hoping to find out.
Great storytelling. This book is great storytelling.
Yeah, not gonna lie, the mask thing that you're talking about freaked me out a little bit. I was like, oh, this is a little spooky.
Like, I want one.
Yeah.
And I love how all the good witches, they don't have brimmed hats, and all the forbidden spell witches, supposedly, like in this lore of the book, all the bad witches had brimmed hats, like regular witch hats.
I actually own a regular witch hat, so I feel a Halloween costume coming on.
Forbidden spell witch.
Okay.
Yeah, that would be a great one. Yeah, and I know a lot of my friends who are into manga are also into all of the cosplaying. And while I was reading this, I realized, oh, like, it would be fun. Like, I understand now, like, what they're doing and why they're doing it. So, yeah, there'd be, I feel like, a lot. Yeah.
People want to be cute and fun and do cosplay. I don't know. Bring out their inner child. That's all we want.
Yeah, so I'm really excited about getting the next few volumes, at least, if not all of them, in the series and seeing where these characters go. I really hope we get more of their backstories, and I hope that the mystery kind of surrounding what's going on gets more twisty and maybe a little bit more dark. But we'll see. What are you guys hoping for?
I'm definitely excited to find out what happens with the mystery that volume one was left on. I'm very instant gratification, so I am definitely getting the next two volumes. They're coming this weekend, so I'm very excited to read them, and I think that is just gonna keep my interest in the series. So I'm very excited to see how different number 12 gets from where we started at number one. I can't really imagine where it's gonna go, so I'm excited to see.
Yeah, just like Marie, I'm super excited to figure out what's going to happen towards the end of this, especially since this manga was categorized as a seinen. So I'm like, oh, is this going to get a little darker? Is this going to get a little bit more action-y? Like, what can we really expect? And then random other hope, because I love anime, there have been talks that this will become an animated series in like 2025, I don't know. It takes a long time. This was announced in 2022. So who knows if it's actually going to happen. I'm still going to keep my hopes up.
That would be so exciting. Yeah, I could see this doing. I say this because, like, I'm biased because I really like this story. But yeah, that would be so fun to watch.
So we're all going to come back here and discuss the anime when it happens. Yeah.
Yeah, the adaptation.
Or when we finish all 12 volumes, you know, when we finally catch up.
I think finish all 12 volumes, the anime should come out, and we'll all meet back here sort of this time 2025. Yeah.
Yeah, sounds great.
Mark the calendar. Yep. All right. Well, if anyone else out there has read these or has suggestions for what to read next, definitely let us know. And happy readings, everybody.
Thank you for tuning in to today's episode of Feminist Book Club, the podcast. Want to be part of the club? Here's how you can join us. Obviously, subscribe to our podcast and leave a rating and review for brownie points. Follow along on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, Pinterest, and TikTok. All of those links are in the show notes. Sign up for our newsletter to be the first to know what our next monthly book pick is. And check out our award-winning monthly book subscription service. Oprah Magazine named it one of their favorite book boxes, and Shonda Rhimes called us one of her favorite subscription boxes in general. There are multiple membership levels for any budget, and it's an excellent way to support the show and the voices you heard today. See you in the club.
Well-read woman is a thing.